This is BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore. In this episode, I'm joined by Paul Whitson, Healing Practice Director at BSA, to discuss future-ready healthcare design. Paul is a graduate of Texas A&M with a BED in architecture, as well as Washington University in St. Louis, where he earned his master's in architecture. He is a member of NCARB and a LEED Green Associate. Prior to joining BSA this past spring, Paul was a regional healthcare leader at HOK. All right, welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm excited to have you on since you joined BSA just in the past several months as our new healing practice director. And it's a rite of passage, in my opinion, for first-time guests to start out by talking about how you find architecture and healthcare architecture in particular. Where does your passion come from?
Well, it was part of my life from a young age. My father is an architect. And between the two of us, we've been licensed to practice architecture for just about 70 years, I think, this year. So I kind of grew up with it, and so I didn't know differently. I used to go to my father's office on Saturdays and build little model airplanes while he was doing his work on the weekends. Should have told me something at the time, but, you know, I was young and in love with hanging out with all the paper and pens and stuff. So I naturally gravitated towards Texas A&M, where he graduated from, and he helped me get a winter internship with HKS, where I worked on the Brooke Army Medical Center back in 1986, 87, and I think now they're about to either renovate, tear down, or mothball that project, so I've seen the full life cycle of a 600,000-square-foot medical center. When I got out of A&M, the only jobs were really with healthcare firms. I ended up working for what was then Watkins Carter Hamilton, or Wakaha, as some people call it. Yeah. And got to know Kirk Hamilton and sort of understood his passion. I took one last sort of shot at being a Black Cape architect when I came to WashU, but I really have the kind of bug for doing healthcare. And I really like the fact that what we do and what I do, there's a real benefit to people every.
And I think I'd be remiss before we jump into our main topic, if I didn't highlight your cooking talents. I know you have a diverse palate and are quite the chef. Can you tell us about where that passion comes from?
Sure. It started at home when I was a kid. The family dinners were very important in our family. When I met my wife and we first were together in an apartment in New York City, we had this little tiny kitchen. It was probably 6 by 8 feet, but we prepared some great meals in there. And we used a service called Fresh Direct, which was way before Instacart. But okay. We could get some really great fish, and we did a bunch of great dinners like that. And now I've started to really focus on my cooking, primarily because of taking care of my health, but also it gives me a kind of sense of accomplishment that I haven't really felt since architecture school. You know, there's always a lot of complications in doing these projects. And so I'm being able to start something, plan it, and finish it in one setting, in one sitting, is really very satisfying.
Yeah. And then seeing other people react, I'm sure, too, like, oh, this is delicious. It gives you a sense of pride and satisfaction, I'm sure.
Yeah. It takes a lot longer to get those kind of things in than in the real world.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot. Favorite restaurant in the world? Like, if you could go anywhere right now for a meal, where and why?
11 Madison Park in New York. I discovered Danny Meyer's restaurants when I was there for almost 2 decades. From the original Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Park Tavern, they built 11 Madison Park when I was living over there, and got to spend some really great meals there. I had one of the best meals of my life there with my wife and some family from Panama. I was there when the Shake Shack original came out, and when I had my own firm, we used to go to happy hour in that neighborhood. And then afterwards, a lot of us would sort of trip over to Shake Shack in Madison Square Park and have a burger and a shake. It was really
sure. Cool. Yeah, that's very cool. Well, I'm going to have to check that place out the next time I'm in New York. All right. So let's shift our conversation topic, because I'm sure our listeners didn't realize they were joining a cooking show. So let's start here. What about designing health for the next generation? What does that mean to you personally and professionally?
Well, I think personally, it's a challenge because the next generation of kids understand health in a different way. My kids have some challenges in health. And so finding the right path in the midst of a lot of noise is always something that we've had to deal with, and it's gotten particularly acute now with all the information coming into over social media. Mm-hmm. I think that for the next generation is how do we configure care to meet people's needs rather than have people, patients running from one place to another, getting different parts of diagnoses, but how can you go into an environment and be able to have everything understood and have not necessarily diagnoses, but treatment plans that will help you? So I think finding that right kind of care and the right way to deliver care is a big part of it. I think that there's going to be an overlay of AI and digital communication on top of that that's really important, but needs to be managed. The thing we talked about recently at a conference about AI was, man, we take care of people, not data. It's important not to overwhelm patients with data, and it's important to focus on how do you get care from the patient side, and then on the provider side is how do you deliver care in the midst of all that?
So more of a comprehensive approach. We're seeing healthcare shift away a little bit from the hospital-centric models. How is this changing the way that we think about design?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a long time. To see a shift from episodic care to wellness, it has a lot to do with the way that hospitals and health systems are deploying care into the community. Ideally, you have different environments that are closer to home so that you don't always have to go to the difficult to get to, hard to get around medical center. And so one of the spots that I've seen that's kind of a emblematic of this is in sports medicine. Mm-hmm. There are a number of facilities that I worked on that were training facilities for professional teams that had a sports medicine component attached to it. And in Atlanta, for where the Hawks and Emory Sports Medicine teamed up, the tagline for Emory was "Go where the players go," and it gives people confidence that they're going to get the absolute best care. It's kind of like in F1 racing, they build these absolute stellar cars with the best, and eventually those things come down to your consumer cars like Honda. And so it's the same kind of model where you're talking about players who are the top athletes in the world. Those kinds of learnings can then inform the care that people get. And so, since it's the same providers, that knowledge is kind of all native to those environments. So I see that learning from healthy people and providing it to people who need care and want to be healthy is a way to improve care before it becomes an acute episode.
I want to shift to asking you about, you've led some major clinical health projects. How are those institutions thinking differently about those spaces today?
Well, when I was working on projects where the care was very centralized, we tried to build these absolutely, they were kind of a Swiss Army knife, has every kind of care delivery possible in one space, in one location. And so those projects got very big and they got very complicated and they weren't always suited for the purpose. Mm-hmm. So now I think that there's an ability to look at how do we develop the least cost solutions for people that really need care close to home? And so BSA has done something really interesting in Columbus, Indiana. They converted a mall to a multi-specialty clinic. And I'm really impressed with it. I have been for a long time with that kind of reuse of community assets to become care delivery sites where people can come to a space that's not threatening. It's not, it doesn't cause anxiety. I go to the mall all the time, drive, park your car, walk in. And then instead of going to the Orange Julius, you go to the orthopedic clinic.
It's hilarious you just mentioned this because, and you don't know this and neither do our listeners, right? But the podcast that will be following this one is a sit down with Columbus Regional Health and our CEO, Tim Spence, to literally talk about that very project. So you're almost making a plug for me. Everybody can come back in a few weeks for the next episode and hear all about that project. It's ironic, too, because I remember being from Indiana. I'd been to the Fair Oaks Mall in Columbus a few times growing up in the 90s. You know, who doesn't go to the mall? And now to see that just transformed into this healthcare space is just tremendous. So thanks for the unintentional plug that you just gave.
Hey, anything I can do for this firm, I'm really excited about. And it's also Columbus is that place where there's all the great
art
projects. So it's a nice nexus.
How do you design for care delivery models that don't even exist? We talk a lot internally, I know, about the future, and you've already mentioned AI. I know I've got several questions looking at the future because I like to think about the future. But it's this interesting concept of, like, how do we design for something that doesn't even exist yet?
It's a really tough question. You know, I've spent over 30 years working on hospital design projects or anything having to do with an academic medical center. So I know a lot about the way that they operate and about the different pieces, but I don't have a crystal ball. Now, this is something that it really takes partnering with experts and clinicians and providers to understand that, and taking some of the concepts that we've been using in some of our work and seeing how they can fit for purpose. There's a series of projects we're doing that have these modular clinic designs that allow them to do multi-specialties and really allow them to be able to shift even during a week between different kind of practices in the same environment. So there are some things that are fundamental. Patient and clinician connection is important. Bedside manner is still important. So how do we facilitate that in whatever kind of way is part of our design challenge every day.
Can you talk a little bit about modular design and prefabrication and early packages and how those play into future-proofing these buildings?
Sure. One of the things that I've been thinking about for a while is, and I can't remember who said this first, it wasn't me, but rather than being future-proof, they're future-welcoming.
I like that phrase.
It's important that we're not taking a defensive or an adversarial adversarial position in this. It's very important that we can look at ways to get the speed to market to happen with the quality that people need to deliver care. At the same time, we need to see what it's like to take. So going back a little bit, a lot of time has been spent working on creating modular solutions for installation and new building to create the speed to market. You know, we need to get healthcare out there to people as quickly as possible. So things like modular OR ceilings, things like the prefab rigs for ductwork in hallways, facades, all those sorts of things, were all designed and are all meant to facilitate installation and construction. I think what's going to be really revealing is in another decade or so, when we're trying to use the same solutions to deinstall or reconfigure. I think that there's an aspect of it that could be really great, meaning if we need to reconfigure an OR and we can take out the ceiling and move it over and do something else, that's got some real merit. And we see some of this in the outpatient market now, where the modular walls, creating exam rooms that can be moved around or reconfigured at a lower cost, really helps. It also helps on the installation side because you have fewer wet trades and everything comes in already plumbed and wired. Right. So having the kits of parts and seeing if they'll work both ways, they work well for going in. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens when they need to be reconfigured.
When I hear reconfigure too, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, it's just the way I interpret it too. There's a little bit of this, like you said, but what if we need to reconfigure in the future? I think of then flexibility. So what does flexibility really look like in a healthcare facility? Are there any examples you can share?
Sure. Zones of flexibility. So on one side of the building, particularly on the OR floors, there's a series of pre and post ops that take an entire side of the building. And then on the other side of the building, there are all these ORs with the support spaces that are configured in a way that they could be changed easily, either as a pod, as a whole side, as a way to handle surge and patient throughput. And so having the building itself be a framework to hang these different kinds of care models on is part of it. Another one is this template project that we've been doing that's now into its, I think, third iteration in terms of building these buildings. And how do we create a clinic model that enables the providers to be able to use it in a way that they are efficient and feel good about doing it, make it easy for the patients to understand as they come in and move around, and make it repeatable so that it's for the owner, they have the understanding that it's going to cost about this much, it's going to take about this long, and it's going to work this well, so they understand what they're getting. A lot of what we do these days needs to be proven as a return on investment or is a fit-for-purpose kind of a thing. So being able to have that as a predictable model is part of what we need to do as we go forward.
interesting too. You're talking about it needs to fit, and a lot of these healthcare campuses are now being planned as community anchors. What does that mean, first of all, and what does that look like in practice?
Well, for me, hospitals are fundamentally civic institutions, and I think that if we keep our focus on that aspect of it, there's an urban planning aspect that absolutely needs to be considered. I know that one great example of that is Eskenazi in Indianapolis, and it has some amazing kind of community assets that really help to engage the community. It starts with the way it's sited. It's got running trails that pass through it. It has a Diller and Scafidio designed cafe to have an anchor for it. But what everybody talks about, and this is kind of the real punchline of that whole project, is the Sky Garden. And the Sky Garden grows food. It's not just a place to relax and get outside and take a break. It grows vegetables that then are taken to the display kitchen in the cafeteria to demonstrate to people how to cook with fresh foods and how to cook more healthy. That's available to everybody. You can engage with the hospital without ever getting into any of the clinical spaces. And so it's got a kind of community home to it. And I think that's something that we're going to see more in projects going forward.
Let's stay with that kind of thread there for a second. You're talking about kind of the outside, if you will, and maybe there's more to it, and I'm not just talking about the inside, but how do you ensure that the spaces that you design are welcoming and inclusive for underserved populations?
Well, there's a lean concept called get to the Gemba, and that really means going where the people are, where the project is, and understanding what the context. Listening is a key ingredient, and privilege is real. As probably the an icon of privilege, I have learned a lot about this in the recent few years, and understand now that the way that underserved communities approach healthcare is very different from me. I've always had insurance. I've always had the ability to get where I need to go. So looking at projects, there have been a couple of recent ones. One of them is the Regional One project, which has just been announced. It's got a lot of press around it. That community has an entire different nature than St. Louis or other places. And so getting down there and meeting the people that were planning the project from the government side, from the hospital side, and starting to see what their priorities are and what conditions them is part of what we need to do. I did a project in Toronto for CAMH, which is the CAMH Secure Facility, which is a forensic behavioral health project. Every meeting we had with the community, and even some we had with the users, they began with a land acknowledgement, meaning that the first peoples in Canada who had inhabited the site, we acknowledged the fact that we benefited from that land. And so taking the viewpoint of the people who were there first, whether it's people in the community or historic peoples, is a big part of it as well.
We often, especially on this podcast too, talk about the patient experience. And I guess I'm curious, what about the caregiver experience? How does that shape your approach to design?
Well, it's interesting because I've spent a lot of time with client leaders, and some of them in particular had a very comprehensive approach to the way that they looked at the design and the way that not only the patients and families engaged with it, but the people delivering care. And in some cases, it's more important. One of the most meaningful projects that I did that way was the ICU at Sloan Kettering. The doctor who led it really pushed us to understand what we were doing would last over time and make it easy for the caregivers to do. One of the things that we did was provide a flooring that's a rubberized terrazzo, which means that the caregivers aren't listening to loud footsteps all the time. That it's much easier on their feet when they're standing. And we put the staff lounge on the corner of the building, and it's on the 11th floor, and it's got a river view, which if you bought an apartment like that in New York, it would be about $1,000 to $1,500 a square foot. So it gives them the opportunity to see something other than clinical space and patients. You can take a minute and get out of the work that they're doing. But also, as we look now forward, how can people use the technology in a way that makes their jobs easier? But I think that's something that's really important, is how technology is going to support caregivers while they're delivering care, and so they don't end up feeling so stressed and spread so thin.
let's stay with the caregivers and the staff for a minute. Workforce shortages are a real challenge. And I know from Terry Joy and Wendy St. John, former nurses talk a lot about the workforce shortage that's going on. So how can good design help with recruitment and retention?
Well, that nursing shortages are real. And we've looked at that a lot in the way that we model spaces. And I know that TJ and her team actually do model the way that people move around so that we can get the best usage from the staff that they have. But really, a lot of it is going to be technological. How is it that AI and virtual nursing can be integrated into the design so that it's supportive to the caregivers, but at the same time, not oppressive to the patients or the families? That may be as simple as disguising some of the cameras, but it also includes things like creating very functional family spaces, because as someone who's had a lot of experience as a patient or a family of a patient in healthcare, the family support becomes part of the caregiving team. And so if we pay attention to that, it can really enhance the experience for not only the patient, making sure that they get the care they need when they want it, but also for the staff who don't have to run to the room so many times because the family have some agency in being able to support.
You bring with you a litany of experience and from all over the country, as we've talked about some of the different locations that you've done projects in and you've lived in. What's one big shift you think you'll see in the next decade of healthcare design?
Starting with more digital connections, meaning that the engagement for a patient encounter will start very far from the actual site of care. People are going to be able to do a lot of things. They can do a lot of things now, but there's going to be more pre-care that can be done digitally. There's going to be more home care and alternative care environments that aren't necessarily an inpatient room or an exam room. To deal with the population who are in between those kinds of care, but also to be able to go home and recover, particularly in recovery. I think this is important because no one really gets peace and rest at a hospital. There's too much going on. So if you can go home and be in your comfortable environment and still have a way for people to read your vitals and help you, that's a really ideal situation.
That's an interesting concept to think about too.
For us as healthcare designers, what does that mean? I think that's going to be a big part of what we need to look at so that we're not focused on just building beds. We don't want to be hammers just looking for a nail. We want to be able to adapt as care changes.
That's a really interesting concept. Yeah, I like that.
There's going to be more consolidation with the kind of reimbursement uncertainty that's out there. A lot of systems are going to be joining with academic health. A lot of systems are going to be combining. Hopefully that provides more equitable access. Hopefully that provides a place where people can really feel like they can go and get care exactly where they are, and we've said where they're at, so they can get care where they need it, when they need it, and not be pushed out of the system because it becomes a kind of monolith. So I think that's part of what hopefully we can do is provide environments that break down the kind of monolithic aspect of some of these systems.
Well, let me take you out of the future and back into the present. What does success look like for you when a healthcare project opens its doors?
It starts with the fact that patients want to be there and that providers love to work there. If we've done our jobs right, however beautiful the building is and however important the finish and fit are, the patients and the providers are the ones that have to use it. And if they're satisfied, then we can be satisfied. I've always stuck to the Vitruvian definition of architecture: commodity, firmness, and delight. Commodity means that it works for everybody, you know? So that's the kind of flow and blocking and stacking and planning that we do. Firmness has to do with it stands up, keeps out the rain, you know, does all those things that make it a building. Delight is that aspect that we really want to bring. That's where we've almost all of us really want to be there. And that's, again, part of why I cook is because I can actually get all three of those things in. So anyway, that's where it is for me. And it's simple, but it doesn't mean it's easy. It's a fairly simple equation. It's not something that's easy to solve. And that's why we really push to have the kind of expertise we do all over the firm that we can bring locally to projects that make them to places.
What's one project that you've worked on recently that kind of embodies this idea of designing for the next generation?
the Orlando Magic and Advent Health Project, because it wasn't just sports medicine. The Magic have always been very acutely aware of where they are in the Orlando community and tried to place their buildings and their capital spend in places that support that community. Well, the new training facility is in a community called Paramore, and they have lived forever in a healthcare desert. And as you can imagine, it's a lower income community that's been cut off by the highway, really, from the rest of Orlando. So they placed the training facility there, and then they invited Advent Health to not only put orthopedics and rehab and performance training, they also have a primary care clinic so that people who live in that community can walk, if they need to an Advent Health top of the line facility to get their care. So when we have that opportunity, and when we have partners that have that kind of vision, we can provide the resources as part of the design. And that's really something that I feel very strongly about. I was preparing for a presentation on that project at Healthcare Design a couple of years ago. And the more I learned about what had gone on and why we had done some of the things that we did, the better off I felt about that project. So it really is a...
That's very cool.
A community asset like you.
Well, this has been great, Paul. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here. And I look forward to all the great work we're going to do together.
I'd like to thank Paul again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with him on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website, BSA Design. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And be sure to check out BSA on social media, including LinkedIn and YouTube. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.